Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
My fellow Americans, the state of our union
will always be strong.
Has never been stronger.
Is strong.
Is strong, but our economy is troubled.
Is sound. Is not good.
Wait, what? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 12th of February. Good as always to have you with us on this, a day of a solemn national ritual. It is, in fact, in the Constitution that the President shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. Political types of all persuasions will be following along word for word, keeping a close ear for their pet issues and interests. There will be applause and analysis, but does anybody keep track of what happens to all the big ideas? From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Eve Troe follows up now on a couple of items from last year's speech.
Robert Puentes is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He follows one of my favorite words, no really. Infrastructure. He says last year's address and the three before that offered a lot for planners like him.
I mean, infrastructure doesn't usually come up in the State of the Union until this president. It really wasn't part of the speech.
Investment in infrastructure was a big part of Obama's stimulus package. Remember all those shovel-ready projects? Puentes says last year's speech was less about getting people jobs with shovels, more of a shift to big-picture planning.
Not just spreading money around like peanut butter all across the country so everybody gets something, but focusing on those investments that matter because they're going to result in long-term economic goals.
That's happening. Slowly. Puentes says the Obama administration has been looking hard at systems. One example, how streamlining shipping and freight can boost exports. Last year's speech suggested the end of the war in Iraq meant more money for that kind of thing.
Take the money we're no longer spending at war, use half of it to pay down our debt, and use the rest to do some nation building right here at home.
But not so easy, considering the debt fight. And war funds can't simply be shifted over to domestic projects.
The reality is that none of those are going to get passed by the Congress.
Chris Krueger is a policy analyst at Guggenheim Securities. He says even though bridges and roads might seem easy to agree on, what the Democrats call investment,
Republicans view it as more failed stimulus.
Until lawmakers build more bridges between each other, no actual bridges are likely to get started. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
It is officially a speech to the Congress that the president will give tonight, but he is arguably talking to the American people. So we asked some of them, some of the Americans that we check in with from time to time, what they want to hear.
The problem with the State of the Union speeches, they're just sound bites. And unfortunately, what I'd like to hear is actually the truth about the economy, an actual plan.
I want him to say that the economy is going to turn around by the end of this year. I'm tired of waiting.
I would like to hear that, you know, the American economy is in a really, really rough shape, and for him to be honest about it, but I don't know that he will.
That was Don Holshue, our truck driver from Iowa. Also, Sandra Morn and Jay Damian from our jobs roundtable about 18 months ago on what they want to hear from the president's speech tonight. On Wall Street today, two up, one down. We'll have the details when we always have the details. The first reports last night were that there'd been an earthquake near the Korean Peninsula. And then the political scientists took over from the seismologists, and it became North Korea's third nuclear test. Victor Cha is a professor of Asian studies at Georgetown University. Professor, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So I have to tell you, saw this news last night and did a little putting two and two together, North Korea being an impoverished state and thermonuclear weapons being really, really expensive. How can they afford to do this?
Well, the economy, Kai, is certainly a decrepit economy, but it's still somewhere in the range of $1 billion in terms of annual production.
Yeah.
In addition, they devote about 30% of the entire nation's resources to the military and to development of weapon systems. So their people are starving, but they're able to do this.
What resources do they have? I mean, it's not like they are, you know, rich in lots of things that people want to buy.
Well, that's true. I mean, they do have a lot of actual minerals in the northern part of the peninsula that they are selling a lot of to China these days. In terms of the nuclear program, they have some homegrown nuclear scientists presumably trained at some point outside the country. And if they are testing this time a uranium device, they have a lot of uranium ore through which they can produce weapons in the future.
Where, though, do they get the cold, hard cash to do this? Are the Chinese and the Iranians and, I don't know, maybe the Pakistanis maybe actually giving them cash to buy the centrifuges that they need?
It's a good question. Simple answer is we don't know. A lot of what their proliferation financing comes out of is illicit activities and front companies that are run by the military that do, in some cases, legal, but in some cases, illegal business with China and with other countries. Counterfeiting has been another thing that they've used. Selling of fake pharmaceutical drugs and cigarettes. All this has been part of a licit and illicit economy that has produced enough hard currency that they're able to buy things on the open market to help produce their programs, the stuff they can get around U.N. sanctions, of course.
Well, speaking of sanctions, the U.N. Security Council is meeting today. There may or may not be something coming out of this. The Chinese are said to be irritated, so maybe they won't veto it. How much more can you sanction a nation that is already so impoverished and heavily sanctioned?
Well, they are heavily sanctioned. They've been heavily sanctioned since the Korean War. But I think this next tier of sanctions will really go after individual assets and bank accounts of companies and individuals who they think are involved in this sort of illicit activity. I mean, in the end, the sanctions are not going to stop the nuclear program. They'll at best slow it down. But at the same time, what else is the UN going to do? I mean, I think they are going to go forward with a resolution that will call for a tighter tier of these so-called financial sanctions.
Let me back you up for a minute. They've got a billion-dollar economy. They spend 30% of it on their nuclear and missile program. So they're doing everything else in that country on $600 million.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, and there's not a whole lot else besides that. I mean, people in the city of Pyongyang live a fairly stable existence, but the majority of the population lives outside the capital city. You know, the population of 22 million lives outside the capital city, and they're really fending for themselves and trying to live off what few scraps they can get from the government and what else they can scrounge for themselves. So if that's the way you run your country, you can develop a nuclear program.
Victor Cha, he's a professor of Asian studies at Georgetown. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
We were talking yesterday on the program about the violence in Chicago, about the economic costs of it specifically to people and to businesses and to whole neighborhoods, in fact. Today, a look at what may well be one of the causes of that violence, housing policy. Chicago has torn down all of its notorious high-rise housing projects, the really bad ones that we all heard of, like Cabrini Green. But a lot of those residents wound up in neighborhoods where the violence wasn't all that much better. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, here's Sylvester Monroe.
What are you reading, Mariah? You going to read to everyone?
Jamaica Smith lives in a Chicago-style bungalow with her husband and daughter on the south side of the city. But she grew up in a housing project on the city's west side. Not such a bad life.
You leave your doors open, everybody knew each other, you know, and it was just like this community knit.
But it didn't stay idyllic for long. Drugs moved in, upstanding residents moved out, and life got tougher.
And we were just like, ooh, they're hanging out on the corners now, you know, and all of a sudden you just see this rise of violence in a community and people just could not walk up and down the streets because they'd get shot.
She moved out of the projects, went to college in Tennessee, and eventually ended up in Marquette Park on the southwest side, just in time to greet an influx of residents relocated from demolished housing projects all over the city, many with competing gang affiliations.
For example, you may have Cabrini Green, who's one gang, and then you have the Hornets, who's another. I mean, and then you put them all in one community area, and then you have, like, war.
Do not cross. It's a yellow police tape, which is about, you know, 30 feet away from where the blood spot is, and which would suggest that we are standing right where that poor 17-year-old kid got shot.
Shot 5 times, in fact, just blocks away from Jamaica Smith's house. Chicago is something of a war zone today. More people were killed in the city last year than U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. But did tearing down the projects cause the recent explosion in violence? Charles Woodyard is CEO of the Chicago Housing Authority.
I think the good news is that after we tore the high-rises down, we moved thousands of families into other areas of the city, that crime was reduced, I think, as much as 60% overall in transformation sites.
Transformation sites, meaning places where the high-rises once stood. And the neighborhoods where project residents moved? Woodyard says crime didn't go up in most of them.
There are a handful of exceptions, though, and it's all about concentration. What I mean by that is the number of these relocated households compared to the number of households in the neighborhood that they live in.
If too many people from the projects ended up in one neighborhood, there was trouble. But Susan Popkin of the Urban Institute warns against oversimplifying the violence problem in neighborhoods where former project residents now use rent vouchers.
The Section 8 holders tend to move to neighborhoods where the rents are low already and the crime is high already.
They went from poor, violent high-rises to poor, violent neighborhoods that already had problems, which did have some effect on the crime rate, she says. Violence was down in 2010, but it would have been down even more in certain neighborhoods if not for the arrival of former project residents.
So I'm not saying there was no effect at all. What I'm saying is that it's not nearly as big as people think it is.
She says that factors like concentrated poverty and the housing crisis shoulder a far larger share of the blame for violence in Chicago.
You have a situation where there are a lot of extremely poor people who have a lot of problems, all living in one place, and you get a situation that's not healthy.
I went downtown to go see.
Wentworth Gardens is a low-rise housing project on the south side. Kids in winter coats are hanging out near the basketball courts, spitting their latest rhymes with varying degrees of success.
My name is Rubber Ducky. No, I can't do it.
On the third floor of one of the buildings, Reggie Lee Ricks is doing word puzzles at his mother's kitchen table. His family was the last to leave the infamous Cabrini Green housing project.
The neighborhood we moved out of, at least we knew everybody. We wouldn't get touched. Over here, you can get touched.
Moving to Wentworth was supposed to be better, but Ricks and his brothers were hassled by gangs that didn't know them. Not that moving is the answer.
It's pretty much the same. Wherever you go, it's going to be the same. People still out here killing each other.
For Ricks, poverty and violence go hand in hand in Chicago.
If everybody had a mansion, don't you think everybody would be way happier? But they say money don't make you happy.
He says step one is fixing how people live. Maybe then it wouldn't matter where you ended up. In Chicago, I'm Sylvester Monroe for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, we're in the midst of a recovery, and yet in my neighborhood, they're still having these what I think are yard sales until I get close, and I see it's everyone's furniture out on the lawn because they've been evicted.
Writing about the Great Recession, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 47 points today, about a third of 1%, finished at 14,018, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ slid 5 points, 0.2%, ended at 3186. The S&P 500 inched up 2 points, 0.1%, 1519 at the bell. Among the financials, Bank of America and Citigroup each registered a roughly 3% increase. Morgan Stanley banked a gain of 1.5%. Today, Goldman Sachs managed to climb about 1.25%. On the tech side, Apple suffered a huge bite, posted a 2.5% loss today after CEO Tim Cook tried to defend the company's cash distribution plan. They have been sued over that plan, by the by. Google slipped 0.25%. Microsoft eked out a gain of about 0.1%. Facebook frowned more than 3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.98. And you? You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for January. It's Ash Wednesday, the beginning of the Christian season of Lent. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And it's World Radio Day. According to the United Nations, as of 2010, there were about 44,000 radio stations to tune to worldwide. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Uncertainty, as we have said more than once on this radio program, makes businesses nervous. Same thing happens with people, too. They can get edgy and self-protective when they don't know what's going on. You throw in weather events straight out of the Bible and maybe more than the normal amount of daily anxieties, and all of a sudden, businesses that cater to customers worried about everything from losing power in a storm to the breakdown of society get a big bump in sales. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
Survivalist used to be just another way of saying right-wing extremist who either hated the government, thought the world would end, or both. But then Hurricane Katrina hit, the economy collapsed, and Superstorm Sandy devastated New York City and New Jersey. Jim Rawls runs the website Survival Blog.
People are feeling anxiety about the economy, about the threat of pandemics, you name it. Preparedness has become big business.
The most expensive thing we sell is your supply of food. It's about $3,500.
Jonathan Dick is marketing director at the Ready Store, an online firm based in Utah that sells emergency preparedness supplies. Dick estimates consumers spend $500 million a year on things like water storage tanks, shelters, battery-powered radios, and, of course, food rations. And then there are all the trade shows, like the Self-Reliance Expo run by Ron Douglas, an entrepreneur in Colorado.
Soap making, candle making, I think we have bread baking, full-on gardening classes, raising rabbits.
Douglas, who charges $10 for a two-day pass to the expo, says he's seen crowds swell from several thousand a few years ago to more than 10,000 these days. You don't have to tell Douglas that this self-reliance industry is becoming more mainstream. He sees it.
You'll see a guy sitting there in dreadlocks and flip-flops, and two seats down is a camoed-out guy, and two seats down from him is a mother with a stroller.
When it comes to marketing, though, Jonathan Dick at the Ready Store says the industry still has some work to do.
If you start shopping around, you'll notice pretty quickly that there is a lot of doom and gloom out there. And frankly, I think it's a lot of people trying to get people to buy stuff by making them afraid.
Dick says, in a way, loading up on solar panels, extra food, and equipment isn't much different than an insurance policy that customers hopefully won't ever need. But if they do, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wrestling is perhaps the original sporting event. Goes all the way back to the Olympics in ancient Greece, at least. But it's likely to be down for the count when the flame goes out after the 2016 games in Brazil, because today the International Olympic Committee recommended getting rid of wrestling. The criticism has been fast and furious, as you might imagine. Truth is, Olympic events come and go. Baseball's last medal ceremony was in 2008, but it's doing fine because of all the popular professional leagues. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now on what might happen to wrestling after the Olympic mat is pulled out from under it.
For Mike Finn, editor of Wrestling Insider News magazine, this is just the latest and greatest blow.
Wrestling, unfortunately, has become an endangered sport in the last 20 years.
Many college programs have gotten the axe as schools deal with scarce budgets and legal requirements to equally support women's athletics. To compete internationally, wrestlers need sponsors. Finn worries money will dry up without the Olympics global stage.
A lot of those people that are helped support wrestling, those corporations, may not be there.
Nearly 300,000 American high schoolers wrestled last year, making it about as popular as swimming and diving. But that number could drop if there's no hope of Olympic glory. Victor Matheson is a sports economist at College of the Holy Cross.
Every kid who's ever been an athlete always imagines himself playing in the big game. If you don't see the great wrestlers standing on the podium, getting that gold medal draped over their necks, it's hard to imagine yourself being the great star and the great athlete.
And wrestling fans find it hard to imagine the Olympics without one of its original sports. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Not unlike the recent hullabaloo over which Monopoly token to do away with, booting wrestling from the Olympics will draw strong emotions either way. So tweet us with your pick of the Olympic event we should lose instead. We're at Marketplace APM on Twitter. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. And just for the record, I still think it should have been that dog. There's a certain magic that comes with reading a good story, even a story that's not about a magical time, necessarily. Say, the last 5 years in this economy. Novelist Jess Walter has a new collection of short stories about people and their lives the past 5 years. We Live in Water, it's called. Hey, Jess, good to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Kai.
These are stories of financial crime, of empty factories, all things along those lines. And I'm tempted to ask you where you get your material, except then you open the newspaper, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think being a former journalist, this is what you see around you. And, you know, we're in the midst of a recovery. And yet in my neighborhood, they're still having these what I think are yard sales until I get close. And I see it's everyone's furniture out on the lawn because they've been evicted. I think these are stories that need to be told, you know. And I also don't think the collection is full of dreary stories. I look in those lives for moments of redemption and light. And for humor,
I want to ask you about the cover of this book. It's a slim paperback. The cover picture is things underwater. There's a school bus underwater. There's what looks like a house or a home or a garage or something underwater. Is that how this past 5 years has resonated for you? That we are all somehow just still sinking a little bit.
It has for me, and it has felt, you know, every bit in the place I live like the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, and it continues to feel that way. The lingering effects and that income inequality to me are going to be things we're stuck with for years as college prices go up, as we price an entire class and generation of people out of the one ladder for advancement. So I do think we've left a lot of people underwater as we've come out of this, and more I think than we even realize.
I want to pick up a little bit on that theme of finding the humor in this. How do you draw humor out of characters whose objective situations are actually quite grim?
Well, I mean, I think it's the first thing you do is go to those places in your own life. I remember the low point. For me, I was driving a $250 car and I was a newspaper reporter and I was divorced and I had no money in the bank and I was on crutches because I'd blown my knee and I was driving to court where I was being deposed for a lawsuit against me for a journalism libel case. And I remember driving along and my car broke down and thinking, well, if this isn't the low point of my life, I don't know what possibly could be. And at that moment, you find, you know, great relief in humor. And as I got out and started hobbling away on crutches and it started to rain, I remember thinking, oh, it can get worse than this. So, you know, I think we've all lived through those moments and that's the way you find your way out of it.
Flip the fiction writing thing you talk about on its head and turn it into fiction reading. Obviously, writing this stuff helps you process what's going on around you. How do you think, as an author, reading about this stuff helps the rest of us process the last 5 years in our lives and in this economy?
Well, I hope it goes even beyond the last 5 years and beyond American poverty. I mean, we're not even talking about the level of poverty, you know, throughout the world. But I think sometimes we view poverty differently than we used to. I was doing quite a bit of research into Depression-era fiction. And at a time then when, you know, one-fourth of Americans were out of work, we didn't tend to blame people for their own poverty, which I think a lot of people do now. We see a homeless person, we almost assume they've done something to deserve it. Writing is an act of empathy, and I think reading fiction hopefully can also bring about that empathy and make you see yourself in their situation.
The latest from Jess Walter is a book called We Live in Water, short stories. Jess, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
With apologies to that old playground taunt, first comes love, and then nowadays comes the wedding website. They're called wed sites, apparently. Nearly 75% of couples now include a web address on their Save the Date cards. Commentator Beth Titel points out that the modern bride has kind of become her own IT person.
Thank goodness I got married in olden times, when the big decision was not whether to make your wedding website password protected, when the words page view and unique visitors were not wedding lingo, when you didn't have to brand your own love story. Have you clicked on one of these sites? Forgive me, but some are more entertaining than the wedding itself. There are polls asking guests to vote on the first dance, pop-up tabs making it easy to pin photos on Pinterest, credits naming the bride's hairstylist, and links to PayPal for honey fund contributions. And pity the couple who didn't meet cute, as they say in Hollywood, because the centerpiece is almost always the blow-by-blow account, or in some cases, the blow-by-blow video detailing the proposal or the How We Met story. The sites are so popular that a new form of wedding entertainment has emerged, mocking others' websites. As one 30-something on the wedding circuit told me, if I don't already know how you met, why am I going to your wedding? Here's another issue not faced by the mother of the bride generation. What to name the website? With more than 2 million weddings a year, not every Michael and Jessica can get their top choice. But if you choose a URL that celebrates your special love and doesn't include your names, forgetful guests may end up at the site of some other Mike and Jessica, reading their adorable story, or even worse, buying them a gift from Pottery Barn. Sure, some sites are tacky, but they are efficient. As one bride confessed, before she got her site running, her aunts called endlessly with questions. Now, she simply directs them to her FAQ page.
Beth Tytel is a staff reporter at the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which Apple CEO Tim Cook inadvertently confirms his company is, in fact, a cult. Speaking at a Goldman Sachs technology conference today, Cook said that whenever he is feeling depressed, he just goes into an Apple store. It's like Prozac or something, he said. If I ever feel myself dropping down from an excited level, I go into a store. Also, and maybe this has something to do with lightening his mood, Cook said the average Apple store generates $50 million a year, $50 million in revenue last year, to be precise. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.